Hey guys, DJ here. This is a disclaimer. Apply Materials is a 100% non-profit fan project set within the Orpheus Protocol game system. The Orpheus Protocol is an actual play podcast and tabletop role-playing game system created by Rob Stith and published by Varkalek Press. If you'd like to know more, please check out the podcast at www.orpheusprotocol.com and patreon.com/orpheusprotocol if you'd like to show more support for the main show. A link to the main show will be provided in the episode description down below. Thank you for your time, and please enjoy the following episode. Welcome to Applied Materials, an Orpheus Protocol actual play podcast. My name is DJ, and I will be your host for tonight. On the cast list for our journey into the unknown, Dave as Eugene Cardenas, Jenna as Annie Sullivan. Tonight's episode, Snatch and Grab, Part 2. Snatch and Grab contains violence, implied threats of violence against children, weird coincidences, and a tread of a new path. Consider this your warning. Previously on Applied Materials, Zenith Squad, having finished their mission in Syria, return to the US and embark on their next assignment, kidnapping the Johnson family from their safe house in Beaver, Utah. What they don't count on, however, is a certain cyborg detective hot on their trail. Firstly, introducing Eugene. So, Eugene, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Eugene is a lanky 28-year-old guy with a mop of curly dark hair and slightly olive skin. And I think the thing that I think most people notice most about him is that in his bluish eyes, he just kind of, how do I put this? He always looks like he's looking past you a little bit. He's got a very contemplative but soft stare for reasons that I hope will become evident eventually.
And so it is this young man that arrives in the town of Beaver, Utah. You are driving through in a rental car. You are heading up to Salt Lake City for a ski trip of a lifetime, as it were, since it is the winter and everything is, oh my God, so cold.
Absolutely. He is definitely bundled up. He has the car's heat cranked to high and it's not quite coming through warm enough.
The irony that you are this cold in a desert is not lost on you.
He flew from his home in Chicago to Las Vegas because he got the tickets on sale, thinking that, oh, it'll just be a quick 6-hour drive. It'll be really beautiful nature, you know, headed up to the mountains. And it has just been desert and it is driving him mad. And for the record, the car I imagine him driving is a Kia Soul. And so he's in this boxy, like white marshmallow car as he's like hunched over the steering wheel.
It's got the heat on and it's so cold. You don't know how it is this cold in Utah, but it is so cold.
He thought he got out of the cold when he left Chicago, and he was so wrong.
You pull into the gas station here in Beaver. It is a small town. You figure probably maybe 2,000-3,000 people at the most. It's not exactly very big. And you're just here to refill your car, maybe stock up on some stuff like snacks and water for the drive up to Salt Lake. Or if it's getting late, you figure you could stay the night here. It's quaint. Very peaceful. Not a lot is happening. And as you pull into the gas station, I would like to know what your vigilance is.
Oh, I thought you would never ask. Eugene's vigilance is a 4. He is very vigilant.
You're getting a few stares. People recognize that someone here is out of town. By the way, they roll in on a rental car and they look like they're not used to the cold here.
I think Eugene just looks around and throws up a very lazy, meek wave, because he can tell people like recognize him as being out of town and he's not really sure what to do in the situation, so he's just trying to avoid suspicion and just, you know, raise a hand like, oh hey.
This is one of those gas stations where you pump your own gas. You're giving the cashier behind the counter in the gas station a little wave. The guy is this probably 17-18-year-old dude, kind of snotty, acne-looking motherfucker, probably just came out of school and does this for like a part-time job because he couldn't get anything anywhere else. He just sort of sees you and gives you an awkward little wave back as you're pumping gas.
Eugene opens his mouth as if to say something, and then he genuinely just can't think of anything. I'm enjoying how purely awkward this moment is. And he scurries back to pump his gas with his beef jerky in tow.
Once you finish pumping gas into your rental car, you head into the gas station itself. It is mercifully warm in here. And the cashier says, "So you're paying for the gas on tank one? Pump one?"
Yeah, pump one and need some more jerky. It's cold out there, isn't it?
Yeah, cold this time of year, but I mean, it's winter, man. It's always cold.
Yeah. How are the roads holding up? You think I'd be able to make it up to Salt Lake tonight, or am I gonna have to find some place to camp down?
I don't know. I think we have a storm warning coming in, like, in a couple of hours, and there might be ice on the road up north, so I don't know, man. Maybe best chance you get, stay in town or something?
Why don't you roll me an empathy check with your charisma, please?
Oh, what? Why'd you have to say with my charisma? That's not Eugene's strong suit. Okay, so he got a plus one on the dice. I doubt he's going to have to use a lot of empathy in this scene. He's not gonna, he wouldn't want to burn any skill features, because he, as far as he knows, this is just a conversation with a normal kid. So he's going to use, he's going to keep his plus one, so he's just going to have a three. You know what, might as well go big or go home on the first. He's going to use three temp strain to bring that up to a six.
So you get the sense that this kid is nervous. Like, you know how teenagers are, especially when they're working a job that they're not used to, talking to people that they don't know, especially from someone who's very clearly out of town.
Mm-hmm.
But you get the sense that this guy is a lot more nervous for a different reason. He's been making small talk with you, and that's fine. But there's this undercurrent of tenseness, of nerves that have nothing to do with him meeting a stranger and having to ring him up for gas and jerky. There's something else bothering him, and you can very clearly tell that despite him trying to put up appearances, it is leaving him noticeably on edge.
Is it possible for me to just take a quick look around to see if I can see the source of it, if it's like in the room or anything?
I'd allow you to roll me just a basic perception check. So just roll your fudge dice and then add it to your perception stat. No need to do awareness.
He got a minus two, so that's just a two.
You look around the gas station. It's a gas station. There's a couple of other people here just perusing the shelves. There's another guy here behind you. He's just pulled in, filled up gas, and he's waiting for you to be finished so that he can pay. Whatever has this kid on edge, you don't see it here. But there's something about him. This just jittery, his nerves are frazzled. It's weird.
Yeah, I think Eugene is gonna, because we've already established Eugene is having an incredibly awkward encounter. This kid, I don't think he's gonna press. I take that back. I think Eugene is gonna push on. Just, he gives an apologetic wave to the guy behind him waiting to check out, and he says, "Hey, kid, is everything all right? Do you drink too many energy drinks to stay up for your shift?"
The kid kind of gives you a look, and he says, "No, sir, no. This is my second time here. I'm just nervous. That's all. It's just nerves. Yeah, totally just nerves. It's not like something bad's gonna happen, right? I think it's just nerves."
Well, you're doing great. And Eugene gives him just a big thumbs up, checks out, and he starts walking back to the car, and he's just really confused about, he's a little worried about that kid. Was there a name tag so I can start addressing this kid by name?
The kid did in fact have a name tag pinned to the front of his shirt, and the name tag reads Francis.
So again, another bit of just Eugene's backstory. Eugene is a teacher, but he teaches middle schoolers. And so to him, like, seeing a teenager in trouble, he doesn't fully understand it, but he has some idea of it. And he's like, "I would like to get better at this in case I need to help someone with this." You know, he knows that kids get nervous, but this kid was acting really weird. I think when he gets back to the car, I don't think he wants to drive off just yet, but the kid did say he's going to have to stay in town. He's not one to just leave something unchecked, but there's not really much he can do without creating a whole bunch of suspicion. Yeah, I guess he figures, you know, this isn't really his, as much as he'd love to help, this isn't really his something he has a right to help with, especially because he knows everyone clocked him as an out-of-towner. He's going to put his stuff in the car and start driving into town to try to find a motel for the night and get an early start in the morning. He's really kind of bummed that he is missing out on the early morning skiing that he was going to get to.
All right. You pull out of the gas station and you trawl the town looking for a motel. There is one. It is pretty close to the town's only golf course. And it is not seedy so much as it is quaint and small. As you're pulling into the parking lot, you can see that it is now roughly midday. You've probably had lunch already on the road, and so this is a good place to sort of ruck up for the night. Especially given the kid's warning of ice on the roads, possibly, and there might be a storm coming in from the north. You're not quite sure how bad it's going to be, but judging from the dark clouds that appear to be gathering on the horizon moving towards Beaver, it's got to be pretty bad.
And Eugene lets out a sigh as he, he's got two bags. He's got three. He's got his duffel, you know, just full of clothes and stuff. He's got his ski bag with his skis in it. And he's got his quote unquote hunting bag. And he stops for a moment and he slings the hunting bag over his shoulder as he goes into the motel to check in.
You head into the motel. The person sitting at the reception desk is this middle-aged lady. She looks kind of bored. She's doing the very stereotypical act of filing her nails. There is a TV on in a corner mounted on the ceiling. It is playing the local news, but at a low volume so as not to disturb other people waiting in the lobby.
This is the kind of place you could just fall asleep.
And she sees you walking in, and she puts down her nail file, and she says, "You need a room, kid?"
Oh, it's been a little bit since anybody called me kid. Just for the night. I'm headed up to Salt Lake in the morning. What's the price around here?
It's gonna be $75 a night, kid. You get a room, either second floor, first floor, doesn't matter to me. You pay your cash up front.
Any port in the storm, I guess. I'm gonna guess there's like an ATM in here, and he just gets some cash out. I'll take third floor if that's all right. And then he internally kicks himself because he has to lug his bags up.
The lady looks at you, looks at your bags, looks at you, shrugs, nods, and she says, "All right, room 302. This one is, you go up the stairs. Once you get out of the stairs at the third floor, turn left, second room on your left." And she places a key with a rather fanciful-looking plastic tag attached to it in front of you.
Eugene smiles at the fancy tag and says, "Well, thank you, ma'am." And then he pauses. He doesn't usually end his sentences with "ma'am." He's like, "Huh, okay, all right, don't know why I said that. Let's go." And he trudges back to his car and grabs his skis, leaving the duffel bag for last so he can drop his stuff in his room.
You make the slow, agonizing trip from car to motel room to car to motel room until all of your bags are sitting on the admittedly rather comfy-looking bed. The room itself is pretty Spartan, although neatly decorated. There is a nice bed. There is a TV that probably hasn't seen good use in, like, what, 5 years? 6 years, perhaps? And there is an attached bathroom. There's a coffee machine and an iron next to the TV. And that's really about it. This is one of those small-town motels that doesn't really see a lot of people, full stop. As you're lugging your last bag from your car over to the motel room, the lady in the reception desk kind of looks at you and she says, "So what's the deal, kid? You're heading up north for some skiing?"
Eugene kind of cocks his head at her and he says, I'm head up to Salt Lake, remember? Yeah, gonna do a little skiing, you know, it's a ski holiday."
"You better be careful out there. This time of year, the roads can get icy."
"Yeah, it's a small town. You probably know. Sorry, no offense, but Francis down at the gas station told me that. That's why I ended up bunking here for the night.
Oh, him. He's a good kid.
Mm-hmm.
He's growing into it. One day he'll take over his dad's gas station. But until then, he's just going to stay the awkward teenager everybody likes around here. He's a good kid. He's got a good heart.
Yeah.
A lot of things have happened in this town lately over the last couple of weeks, though. It's got everyone on edge. Can't really blame him.
That explains it. I was getting a little worried about him. I don't know him, but I was kind of freaked out. He seemed pretty freaked out. What's going on?
You might want to have a seat for this one, kid. It's a bit of a long story.
Oh, sure. Sounds great. I was that or just watching the TV upstairs. And Eugene grabs a chair and pulls up to the desk.
You can see the lady, she gets out from behind the counter and actually leaves the reception area to just sort of lean on the counter on your side. And she says, "So, I heard a couple of weeks ago, the local cops, they had a problem with, well, there's no better way to put this, a serial killer out here around these parts. Turns out that the killer was one of them, some yahoo who had enrolled with the local police department one or two years ago. Didn't really know that they were, like, twisted and shit. And so they had a problem with that for a while. That got fixed a couple of weeks ago, and so the guy's dead. Like, that serial killer's dead. Like, they shot him dead, stone dead. And the town's been trying to go back to normal. And then there's been a bunch more trouble showing up, like, last week and stuff. I'd recommend you don't go out at night, or try not to, at any rate. We've got a bear around these parts now, apparently. And it's apparently not hibernating, and so far, I think, according to the police, it's eaten, like, what, two people? Three? I'm not sure. Might be rumors. Might be hearsay. I don't know.
I'm sorry, did you say it ate two or three people?
Yeah. It's not pretty. I mean, that's what I heard, like, I'm not sure, like, what the exact cause of death was. They said it was, like, wild animal stuff, but people dying in a small town like this, you kind of tend to take notice, you know?
Of course, there's not that many people to die. Well, fingers crossed that Francis is safe in there. I assume these doors lock pretty tight around here.
Yeah, and plus, well, you're on the third floor. I've never seen a bear that has purposely wandered upstairs to go and look for someone to eat, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, we don't get many bears out in Chicago.
Ah, so that's where you're from. Yeah, no, there's no bears out there, are there? You're probably running risk of getting stabbed more than getting eaten by a bear in Chicago.
Well, I mean, there's the Chicago Bears, go Bears, but yeah, no. Well, thanks for the heads up. Is there a name tag on the motel receptionist?
Doreen.
Oh, thanks for the heads up, Doreen. You stay safe. Serial killer. Gosh, this is an interesting town you got here, Doreen.
It's never supposed to be interesting. No business is good business for that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
I totally get it. Well, you stay safe. And, hey. And he points to his hunting bag. He says, you know, I got some hunting supplies. The bear comes a knocking, you can just come up and get me. I'll keep it safe.
She does a kind of cringy finger guns and winks at you, and she says, "Yeah, well, I'll make sure to put that bulletproof glass up there behind me if and when that bear shows up. You know, maybe it'll save me. Maybe it won't. Who knows?"
And with that, I think he'll thank Doreen for the story, and he'll hunker down for the night.
So you end up in your motel room for the night. You've gone out for dinner and come back here, and you can feel the chill of that incoming storm front sort of blast you in the face with a wave of cold air as you were walking across the parking lot to the motel itself. And as you enter your room and finally relax in warm blankets after you've had a nice hot shower, you click on the TV just for some background noise. And that's when your hunting bag, you can feel it sort of vibrate the air.
Eugene sort of bucks up instantly and looks at it. He's going to sort of approach it and unzip it.
What does your bow look like?
So what it is it's a composite bow. It's made of, there's some wood and sinew that is, fairly unadorned. There's no really special, but the really beautiful part is that there is on the belly of the bow facing, the archer is this gorgeously polished horn that it almost is a little speckled like the night sky. So facing the bow, you wouldn't really think much of it, but it's this really beautiful composite bow with a beautifully polished horn back.
The bow is calling to you. And when you put your hand on it to pick it up and just give it a look or two, you can hear its voice in your mind, as it does often. When you've traveled with this bow, you've hunted a few things with this weapon, and you've gained some experience and insight into the way this bow works. Specifically, the way it works for you.
And when he hears the bow's voice in his mind, is it guiding him towards any specific place?
The bow senses a great beast nearby, worthy of a hunt. And it gives you an image of golden eyes in a shroud of darkness. A many-fanged, many-clawed beast of great size and shape and weight that has drawn human blood in this area and will continue to do so if not stopped.
Well, in that case, Eugene is going to nod towards the bow, and he is going to, the way he usually does, take the bow, and he's going to lie down on the bed and go to sleep and activate his astral projection.
All right, so I need you to make me a discipline check with your focus.
You got it.
And for the rank 2 of astral projection, you need to make this against a DV6.
That is exactly a 6 on the dice. I don't have to spend any additional things because I made a DV6.
All right. What does Eugene's astral projection look like?
So for this, I really think it looks like him, but made of gold. And for some reason, no matter what he's wearing in his astral projection, he's wearing a set of golden robes, almost like pajamas, but not quite. And I think for any creature that could see him, though I'm sure not many can, he leaves a slight gold twinkle behind him.
You leave your body behind as you fly out over the small town of Beaver, Utah. And within what feels like only a moment, you find yourself hovering next to what must be surely in your life, short as it has been on this planet Earth, the biggest black bear you've ever seen. It is currently rummaging through a dumpster outside of some sort of cafe, eatery, diner place. You're not quite sure. It is gigundous. It is an absolute unit. And it is currently face first in this dumpster, paw just sort of swiping through the trash, trying to find, probably, you think, something to eat. And at first the scene looks kind of normal, because you've seen bears before. You've seen bears rummaging through trash before in other states and in other cities. This is not really normal, but you've seen this before. It's not really unfamiliar.
It's not out of the ordinary.
What makes it stand out from out of the ordinary, though, is when the bear stops what it's doing and its head leaves the dumpster. You can see like a little soda can just falling off of its head. And it's standing up on its hind legs, and oh my god, this thing is huge. And it's looking around, sniffing the air, kind of hesitantly looking from here to there. And then it locks eyes with you.
Oh no.
And it glares. And I would like you to make a horror check, please.
I would love to. I David got scared. That is a flat on the dice for a result of 4. I'm going to spend the 3 temp strain I have in discipline to bring that up to a 7.
So you pass, standing to lose 3 preventable clarity damage.
I'll spend that down to nothing.
Did Eugene actually say you scared me? Or is that you?
I said that, but I actually like the idea of Eugene saying that.
And as the words leave your lips, the bear responds,
"You should be."
Eugene jumps, and he is immediately going to bring up his spectral bow and knock an arrow.
As you do this, you hear and see a door opening behind the bear. And emerging from this door is this middle-aged man. He looks kind of Asian to you, and he's got two big trash bags slung over his shoulder. And he sees this bear just standing there, looking like it just rummaged through and made a mess of his dumpster and then is looking at something. And the trash bags fall onto the floor with an audible thump. The bear wheels around, sees the human standing there, turns back to you, and it growls as if to say, "We'll settle this another time." And then it just runs away, passing through you and disappearing into the tree line behind you.
I think Eugene, without even like thinking, has when the bear barrels towards him, he like puts his arms up defensively, and then it just passes through him. He's like, "Oh yeah, oh right, yeah, never mind." He sighs, and I think normally he would like continue trying to explore, but I think this moment, and specifically because the bear said, "We'll settle this another time," he's not gonna go looking for trouble right now. He's going to return to his body, which he can see is soaked in a cold sweat.
It almost feels like the heat isn't on in your motel room as you return to your physical body. The chill in the air is palpable. It is wrapped around you in an embrace like a cloak.
What the hell was that thing?
You don't know, but your bow says to you that it was the quarry of your hunt, the great beast that is terrorizing this area. A worthy hunt for one such as you.
Eugene puffs his chest out, and he's used to the bow mainly he's used to not getting many responses from the bow when he asks it questions, mainly just vague instructions like this. But I think he returns to it, and he just thinks, if this is a worthy opponent, is it honorable to pursue or to let it set the terms?
It would be more honorable for you, says the bow, to let it set the terms of this fight. Because what has happened here is you've stumbled onto its hunting ground, and you're trying to be the dominant alpha male predator in its territory now.
Eugene nods, and he quickly writes all of this down in his...
And so you fall into a fast, deep sleep. Your dreams are inhabited by this strange creature, this abnormally huge bear that can talk, and it saw you in your astral form. You don't know how it happened, you don't know why, but it's just so weird. It's so strange, but you know that even though this is not what you're here for, this is a worthwhile use of your time before you go on your ski vacation.
Skiing can wait.
You wake up the next morning feeling rather refreshed, buzzing with energy. You're just ready to go. You're raring to get out there, find this bear, and fuck its day up.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear the sounds of gunfire in the air and police sirens echoing down the street. Annie.
Uh-huh?
I'd like you to roll me a horror check, please.
Dang it! Here I was, thinking I was gonna get away from it.
Nope.
All right. I guess if I gotta, I gotta.
Yep. Someone's shooting at your house. In fact, someone might be shooting your house.
Yeah, someone's shooting my house. It's my house. I got people over. They're gonna really shoot at my house when I have guests? Well, it's not great. Okay, so I've got a +1 on the dice, and I've got my willpower being the 3, so I'm at a +4. I will actually go ahead and spend the 2 strain now to make that up to a 6.
Okay, you pass, standing to take 5 preventable sanity damage.
Okay, I will then spend 2 spiritual strain, so that way I only take 1 point of damage.
And now I'd like you to roll me a breakdown check. Which
Damn
is
it.
Just.
I swear to God. I just get started on this adventure, and I'm already having a breakdown. Okay, it's fine. It's a +1.
You're fine. This doesn't happen all that often, but someone's shooting at your house, people are in danger, and you are a police officer. 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah.
You follow Sergeant Sam out of the police station and into your car. Max is at your heel. He is wagging his tail. He's very excited. He doesn't know what's going on, but oh boy, I get to go out again with my favorite human beings in the world.
He's just a good boy.
He is a very good boy. The three of you speed down to where your house is, and the first thing you see is a police car in the middle of the street. It's sitting at a sort of 45-degree angle-ish, almost, on the street. Both of its doors are open, but the more pressing matter is that the two police officers that were supposed to be in this car are lying on the floor, very, very dead. You can see that one of the police officers looked like they were hiding behind the engine block of the police car after being injured. As you get closer, you can tell that it is a woman. Apparently, this officer had taken fire from somewhere on the street, gotten hit, and then proceeded to crawl out of the police car and hide behind the engine block and front tires, because you figure the tactical advantage of putting as many pieces of thick metal behind the tactical advantage of putting as many thick pieces of metal between you and a shooter is what went through this officer's mind. But she was injured. You can tell that there's blood inside the police car on the driver's side seat where presumably she was, and her corpse is sprawled out on the asphalt. Still warm, your optics can tell. Her ride-along, her partner, is in the passenger seat. It appears that he is also very much dead. He's just sitting there, slumped in the chair. Wherever the shooter is, they don't appear to be firing anything anymore. And there's some very nervous neighbors peeking out of their doors, just looking down at you, looking across the street, trying to figure out if it's safe to come out. What do you do?
Okay. All right. First things first, we're in a shooter situation, so I am going to pull my gun and doing the crouch walk. You know how they do? And using the enhanced optics, going to figure out the angle at which the gunfire came from, particularly from the officer who's still in his seat.
All right. Roll me an investigation check with your perception. And since you're using your enhanced optical targeting system to help you figure out and triangulate the angles of fire, I can say that that gives you a situational plus one.
Hella. All right. That's a positive one on the dice. Actually, no. I'm going to do my my free reroll, being as good at investigation as I am. All right, same thing. Okay, that's fine. With my perception, that makes it a 2, but I am absolutely going to be spending the strain needed to boost that up. I will spend 2 more strain to boost that up to a 4, and then using the environmental bonus or the optical targeting bonus, that'll bring me to a 5.
You don't know where the shooter is. You don't hear any shooting, but you crouch walk your way to the police car. You can see that its hazard lights are still on. The flashing police lights are still on, but the siren is off. And you just hunker down behind the rear wheel well, and you peek your head up over the side of the car to peek into the cabin itself, just to try and have a look at where this guy might have gotten shot from. And it looks like all of the bullet impacts on the side of the police car didn't go through the doors because, well, this is a police car and it's armored. It's supposed to withstand gunfire. So you don't see any exit holes on the other side of the inner car door where the passenger is sitting. And all of the gunfire seems to have been concentrated at the windows, which have broken and busted inwards. You can see that there is a scattering of glass shards across this guy's lap and on the floor of the passenger side, as well as the driver's side, as well as along the windshield. And when Samuel's got you covered, you circle around to the front of the car just to mostly clear the street, but also to have a look at the bullet impacts. And you can see that a lot of the bullets came in. You kind of figure from about 10, 15 feet away, they were very close. And this was from a high-powered rifle. Small, thin impacts that don't drive up a lot of paint, But because the car's glass window is broken, you can imagine that this was a powerful enough rifle to just punch through that thick layer of bulletproof glass that protects the inside of the car from any damage. You and Samuel spend a few minutes checking the surrounding scene, looking through the houses that surround this neighborhood and street, and eventually you clear the area. The shooters don't appear to be here anymore. Now, with your investigation check, and now that you are sure that the aggressors here aren't here anymore, a few more details come to you. As you holster your gun and inspect the scene, you can see that on the street, there appear to be a set of tire marks, like if someone had performed a high-speed burnout, and they appear to be speeding away from you. Not down the street where you just came from, but the other way, further up the street. Looks like whoever these people were, they might have left town after what happened. Secondly, when you go back to the police car to further inspect, well, the car and the corpses, the body of the female officer that is laying behind the car, she appears to have been executed with a single bullet to the head. Her original injury looked like a graze to the shoulder and to the forehead, which explains the profuse amount of blood in this area. You know that the human face is one of the highest bleeding areas on the human body. Even though a wound there can be non-fatal and very minor, it's just the sheer number of small blood vessels in the face makes it bleed more than most other places. But there is something about the surgical, clinical brutality of this woman being shot just at point-blank range in the head to secure a kill that makes you believe that these assailants knew what they were doing, some manner of professional, either soldier, mercenary, you're not quite sure. Max is barking at your house.
That's certainly enough to snap me out of any stupor I might be in. I'm gonna run into the house.
As you run towards your house, you can see that your front windows that face your lawn, they have been busted inwards, completely broken. But you don't actually see any sign of tire marks on your front lawn, like if someone had hit the front of your house with, say, a vehicle. No, this feels like someone walked up to your house and just hit your plate glass window with so much force that it shattered inwards. And you know that the plate glass in here is tempered, so something real strong must have come through here. What's your vigilance at?
My vigilance is 2.
It's quiet. Very quiet. Other than the sounds of glass tinkling and the hiss of smoke coming from the squad car's engine, it's awfully quiet. Max is at your heel. He's panting, looking up at you. He's on alert, but he's also looking for instruction or an order. And Annie, you remember that you were supposed to be housing people here. A family. A woman and her 2 children.
So, going to just pat the side of my thigh in a follow command and crouch walk back into the house because they could still be hiding in there.
All right. Max is at your hip. He is glued to you as you crouch walk into the house through the broken window. You can hear faintly behind you the sound of boots crunching on grass. And when you look behind you, you see Sam on your heels. He is back towards you, keeping his gun towards the street. As you enter your house, it's quiet, very quiet, and what bothers you is just how quiet it is. Normally, you would be looking out for someone calling for help now that the shooter has gone away, but there's nothing. You remember that you housed Susan and her 2 children in your guest room upstairs.
I'm not going to call names out just yet, but I'm going to make my way upstairs. And methodically, as if I had just learned it in the academy, clear every single room.
A perfectly reasonable thing to do. You and Samuel do that with precision and efficiency. You treat your house as if it were a training course, and you slowly but surely clear every single room, ending with the guest room, where you find that the door has been knocked off of its hinges, and Susan and her 2 children are nowhere to be found in your house.
The windows being broken and the guest room door being knocked off its hinges, is there any other signs of a struggle or a fight or clutter?
There is that baseball bat that you gave Susan, just in case of emergencies. It's lying on the guest bedroom floor. But there are no signs of a scuffle. There are no signs of a fight. There is no blood inside your house at all, just the broken glass. It says to you that whoever came for Susan and her children clearly must have talked the mother down, because it looks like she went along with her kids without a fight.
Internal dialogue speaking here. Either they talked her down and convinced her to go with them, or she was under threat of some sort. With that in mind, I'm going to pick up the opposite end of the baseball bat away from the handle and present it to Max to sniff.
So Max gives the baseball bat handle a sniff, and he looks around the room, kind of circles around it a few times, sniffs the bat again, and then he walks out of your guest bedroom and downstairs. He leads you all the way back out onto the street where you see these tire marks are. He sniffs around here a few times, and then he looks down the street where you presume the van or car must have disappeared after they took Susan and her kids. His ears are perked up, they're on alert. He sniffs the ground again and then looks in that direction again.
All confirmation I need has been presented for me to make this decision. Annie will turn to Sam, just blazing fury in her eyes. Sergeant Langley, you need to secure this area. I'm going on ahead. We have a kidnapping.
Sam already has his gun holstered and he's on his phone. And he looks up at you and he says, yeah, all right, just go. I'm calling for backup. They'll be here soon.
And then upon hearing him say that, she will get right back into the car, making sure that she's got Max because that's her good boy, and follow those tire marks.
The skid marks go for a few feet before they eventually peter out. Whoever was driving this vehicle did a sort of high-speed burnout that left these tire marks on the asphalt. And of course, they lead away from the scene of the crime. But you don't have a definitive enough trail to follow them the whole way, because as soon as the vehicle here that you're following has got up to speed, there are no more skid marks on the asphalt anymore, just a blend of tire tracks indistinct from each other from various different vehicles that have come and gone before the incident took place. There is no definitive trail for you to follow, and eventually the road leads you to the highway leading out of your town.
Upon reaching the highway, I will pull over to the side, give my steering wheel a good hearty smack, and take this chance, take a deep breath in, take this chance, going to pull out my phone and dial Susan's number, because there is a chance that she did take it with her. Whether or not it's her that picks up or not, what matters is if it gets picked up at all. So I will call that number.
You give Susan's number a dial, and it rings, it rings, it keeps ringing. And then it goes to voicemail from ringing too long. But the moment you hang up the call, you receive a text message from her phone that says, I'm fine, kids are with me, don't know where we're going, but we are safe.
It is going to be a very tense ride back to the police station. I do trust Sergeant Langley to take care of the scene, as horrific as it may be, and there probably is a little pang of guilt thinking about just like leaving him there to take care of two bodies on his own. But that's okay, because I'm going to go visit Dr. Nguyen later at the hospital for other reasons anyway. But yes, going to go down to the police station, and once I'm there, set up on my computer, because the phone was ringing multiple times, and she was able to send a text from her phone, meaning the phone is not dead, meaning it's traceable.
All right, yeah, you do that. You stop by Sergeant Langley. He is still stationed outside your house, looking rather tense. You tell him that you're heading back to the station to try and trace Susan's phone. And as you leave the scene, you can see that coming your way are two more police cars. The backup that Sergeant Langley had requested is heading your way. You return to the police station and immediately hop onto your computer. You hammer in Susan's phone number as well as other details about her phone that might help with your network trace. It takes a while for your triangulation software to accurately pinpoint the location of her phone. But when you find it, you can see that it is going out of your town northwards along the highway. There is no definitive destination, it looks like, but Susan's phone appears to be traveling at highway speed north out of your city. And from the looks of it, she appears to be about 5, maybe 6 minutes out. Not altogether impossible to catch, but the longer you stay here, the less time you have.
So Annie's going to call the police station out in Meadow, which is a good bit north on the highway, but it'll be good to have them cut off. So she's going to give them a call as she's pulling away from her computer and getting back into her car, just because 5 to 6 minutes out, that is still doable, provided she's got her sirens going and she's not going to run into anything else. But yeah, she's going to call them as she's getting into her car and give them as much detail as she can, which honestly isn't a lot, but to start doing inspections on the toll roads specifically, and to keep an eye out for a woman and two children with, you know, potential other individuals with them. And then she will give descriptions of Susan and her two kids.
All right. You do that. The police officer on the phone with you, the deputy, takes out all these details. You can hear them taking their time, scribbling down something on a scratch pad or something else. And then they say to you,
okay, yeah, we'll be on the lookout. We'll keep people on the roads checking vehicles for a woman and two kids who might be under, you said, duress? Like is a kidnapping?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. We'll do that. If you get any more information about the vehicle, let us know. Otherwise, this could take a while.
Understood. I'll be on my way now.
All right.
And then they hang up. What do you do?
I'm going to go back out to my car, shoot a text to Sergeant Langley to let him know what I'm doing. So if he sees another squad car barreling down the highway, it's me.
Samuel texts back, pick me up on the way. You will need help.
She'll respond back, copy, and she will start driving back towards the scene to go pick him up because it is on the way and she is going to need help.
All right. You drive back to your house. The two patrol cars that you saw earlier have set up shop here. There are a bunch of police officers cordoning off the area, talking to neighbors and witnesses and the like. And as you pull up to the side of the road to pick up Samuel, he is standing there. He's just fanning himself a little bit. He looks rather harried, but shows no sign of slowing down as he hops into the passenger seat of your car. And he says, all right, let's roll. I'll fill you in along the way.
Hearing that, she will flip on the sirens and put the pedal to the metal.
You screech out along the road, heading towards the I-15. And as you drive, Sergeant Samuel, he is busy pulling on a bulletproof vest as he says, so the other officers and I talked to some of the neighbors around the area, and they all confirmed sort of the same thing. There were three individuals in a black panel van that arrived outside your house a while ago in the morning. We had, you know, our buddies keeping watch outside of your place for protection reasons, and they saw this van just sort of sitting there. They put on the lights and sirens, all of that good stuff, and a man appeared to come out of the van and just start shooting with an AR-15. According to the other witnesses, it looked like there was another man and a woman that then exited the van and broke into your house. They left a while later with your charges, and then they all bundled into the van and drove away lickety-split. I'm assuming we're following Susan's phone, right?
Correct.
All right, good. Let's go get these fuckers. This has been Applied Materials, an Orpheus Protocol actual play podcast. A warm thanks to our players tonight. Dave for playing Eugene. Jenna for playing Annie. Be sure to follow the show at Applied Mats on Twitter, and we will return in the next episode. Good night. Eugene finds himself the target of a hunt and resolves to end the great bear that threatens the town. Annie and Zenith Squad face off, with dire consequences to their brief battle. Next time on Snatch and Grab, Part 3.